Hello and welcome to Dialect from the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol and listeners on Preston FM, that's 103.2 FM up there in Preston, and Radio Verulam in St Albans, also to our new listeners in Swindon. Hello Swindon FM.
Coming up later in the show, we have a report from an Italian war correspondent based in Rome about his recent trip to Libya. Stephen Loft Simpson is back with us again this week to talk more about his great knowledge on sedan chairs. We also hear Peter Gould from the Ramblers Association. He is our second guest today in the studio tonight.
Malcolm Grieve reads Part 4, Chapter 22 from Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. We have Duncan Moore, a folk singer from Stoke-on-Trent, who will be singing us a song. And we also have the same from Tim Burrows. Mike Noyce interviews a Bristol artist, Jacques Arobin. And also Jeff Sparks is back with the What Song Guide. I'm Michaela Dennis.
And I'm John Peters Coleman. Well, picking up from last week, eagle-eared listeners will remember that I was chatting to a fellow named Stephen Loft Simpson, who is a specialist in sedan chairs. He's here again. Hello.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. So, picking up where we left off, let's just remind people of the nature of sedan chairs. It's an enclosed seat with glass windows, and there's a man at the back and a man at the front, and they transport the person inside.
Indeed.
Indeed.
And they get larger as people grow bigger.
That's interesting. So the first ones in the 17th century would have been...
smaller, and they tend to have a step up of size in about 1710, 1715, that sort of period.
Okay. Is that perhaps why they stopped sometime in the early 19th century? Were people getting too big?
No, I don't think that was. I think it was the towns were getting too large and you couldn't carry people sufficiently far. There was a limit normally of 1 mile in some places and 2 miles for taking a taxi.
Okay, so they originated in London. Was that where they would have been most popular? Because obviously that presumably would have been the largest city with the greater distances.
Yes, they really took on from previously people had used the waterway and watermen to go up and down the Thames. But when London expanded, it was 7 miles from Limehouse to just beyond Westminster Abbey. And they expanded north and south. And obviously the waterways weren't there, so that was one of the reasons they used sedan chairs.
Did they charge extra for fat people?
Oh no, you had to carry whatever weight there was. And I think the record was between the Bath chairmen were carrying someone 4 miles who weighed 15 stone without setting them down. Well, that's putting them down.
They must have been absolutely ripped to do that sort of thing. There must have been a great amount of physical exercise. Was there a lot of money in being a sedan chair carry person, or was it?
There was some money for the very rich. If you carried someone wealthy in the equivalent of Princess Diane today, you had her secrets as well, because you knew exactly, or Nell Gwynn in the time of Charles II, you knew where they went, you knew who they saw, and frequently when they died, if you outlived them, they left a small amount of money for you. But the job wasn't for very long. If you look at all the royal sedan chairmen, many of them were only six or ten years in the service of the crown.
Okay. There has to be a certain amount of physical coordination. We covered this a little bit last week. The guy at the front has to know what the guy at the back, you know, is doing with his movements. You know, a little bit like the Chuckle Brothers trying to move a sofa. I mean, was there a workman's terminology that was specific to sedan chairman? As you know, in a lot of industries, you get sort of terminology that originates from a particular industry.
Yes, to me, there wasn't between the two chairmen, but the front chairman, you know, was shouted, by your leave, and all these sorts of things to let people know that they were coming. Because once you were moving forward, and they used to move at, you know, 4 miles an hour, if you happened to be wandering along the pavement, and there were various foreigners who got pinned to the railings as the sedan chair passed because they didn't know the terminology.
Okay, so were they perhaps seen by some people as a little antisocial, rushing around at a fair rate?
Yes, by some, and in one or two places, I think Birmingham's one of them, they weren't allowed on the pavement. They had to walk on the roadway. But of course, originally, there wasn't a pavement. The raised pavements only came in generally in about 1760s.
Okay.
They were just posts. The main point was the rear chap had to avoid all the posts and swing round wide to avoid all the obstacles. And then, of course, the rear person, until they lengthened the poles, couldn't always see the holes in the road or so on, so they could trip up.
Right. How far and wide have you travelled in pursuit of your love of sedan chairs? Does this cause you to sort of travel abroad?
I've done several trips abroad, often about 4 or 5 a year. One sort of trip is to view it at an auction house and add a few extra in. If a sedan chair is for sale in an auction house, you have 3 days to view it. There's 1 day of the sale, if you don't get the information there, you may never see it for 100 years, and by which time I won't be here. So it's gone. It could be, of course, not sold and be in another sale in 2 or 3 weeks' time or 2 months' time. But
So were they a broadly British phenomenon?
Most sedan chairs which survive, 40%, are French. And when I originally started, I assumed because the French population in the 18th century was twice what the English was, I think it was roughly 20 million to 10 million.
Yeah.
There would be twice as many, but there were, in fact, four times as many. The French had far fewer public hire chairs, taxis in the modern term,
yeah,
but they had far more private ones.
Okay. I mean, you've been interested in sedan chairs for about 13, 14 odd years.
Indeed.
Do you make a living out of, you know, your expertise in sedan chairs? I mean, you're the foremost expert in Europe. Do a lot of people call on your services as an expert in it?
A certain amount. I've just completed this year the listings for the National Trust. They've been listing all their transport. In fact, they're listing, I believe, their furniture collection. In fact, I had an email back today to say, did you know we had the festoon blinds for the sedan chair you saw up in our attic? And I said, no, I didn't. I'll add that to the list.
Right. Are they particularly valuable, the sedan chairs that remain as historical artefacts?
The full-size sedan chairs are less valuable than the Fabergé miniatures. But that's not to say, for instance, that the one Christie's was selling last week, I think, made £20,800.
Right.
Which was a Genoan sedan chair in Cowdrey Sale in Midhurst. But I bought the same sedan chair style,
yeah,
falling apart, for £300. So
okay,
there's a big variation.
Since people of a certain amount of money would have been the people to use them, did you tend to get only one class of sedan chair, or did you get sort of different varieties of them? You know, the sort of the Ford Siesta equivalent of a sedan chair, but then you can have the Rolls-Royce equivalent with,
yes,
extra trimming, extra
fittings? Well, the way I pointed out today, I think there's a Toyota IQ, or you can have an Aston Martin version of the Toyota IQ for, yeah, four times the price.
So if you had extra money, what would you be, you know, if you were, say, going to buy, you know, the best sedan chair, what sort of extra fittings would you perhaps have put in?
Yes, you have extra ornamentation on the exterior, whether that, in Europe it's generally carved wood, and in London we were the first to use stamped metal. And on the interior, because they were mainly ladies' transports or women's transport, 70% of the private chairs were used by women and owned by women. There'll be a small percentage who are disabled or can't walk or lame or suffering from gout, of course, some of the men did. That made a difference.
Okay. Have you written any books or literature on this?
I've written a short 3-page piece which just generally lines out the short history from Roman times to the present, touching on many of the subjects in one sentence. But yes, I have written a whole 110 pages, but it's not finished yet.
What sort of community of interest is there in sedan chair? And do you know anybody else who is as interested as you are?
Oh, no, no, no. No, they're interested in their Pacific item.
Yeah. So what's to stop you from being a world expert in sedan chairs? You carefully described yourself as only the European expert. I'm interested to see, you know, is there an African expert in sedan chairs?
Not that I'm aware of, but since the days of Google's gone rather worldwide, if you type in on Google sedan chairs and images, you'll get more Chinese ones than you'll get European ones.
Okay.
So it's significantly changed. And the Chinese ones, there aren't actually many beautiful Chinese sedan chairs. There are a lot of bridal chairs, which brides use to be carried to their weddings in.
Okay.
But they don't have any glass windows.
What sort of history of sedan chairs are there in China then? I mean,
having not been to China, I wouldn't like to speak too much, but what I do have is the IKEA equivalent of a sedan chair, where you can lift the roof off the four sides, put it all on a flat pack things on your cart and move it off to the next village, and that I think is about 1905 1900.
Okay. Can you still use a sedan chair for like special occasions? You know, you mentioned a wedding. Can you sort of hire out a sedan chair for your wedding?
I did take a pair of sedan chairs to a wedding in Bath once, which worked fine until the chairman had a few drinks as they were the ushers, and then there was a suggestion to make a better photo if the bride and the bridegroom leant out of the windows and kissed each other.
Okay.
Well, I thought there might be difficulties there, but in actual fact it all went fine. And
Do you have a website or somewhere where people can go online and find out more about your interest?
Yes, I put a very little on my website, sedanchairs.co.uk.
Okay.
But I've also got sedanchairs.org. I haven't got sedanchair.com because that was already listed by someone else.
Excellent. Thank you very much for all of this interesting trivia and gossip about sedan chairs. That was very interesting. So Stephen Loft-Simpson, thank you very much for coming in. And perhaps you can go online and find out more, folks.
You're welcome. Bye.
Dialect's reporter Anthea Page was at a recent screening of Bloody Spring, Libyan conflict, and afterwards she had an interview with Flavio Grimaldi, who made the film with the support of the umbrella organisation Global Civilians for Peace in Libya.
Fulvio Grimaldi, journalist, war correspondent based in Rome, 45 years of professional experience.
Tell us about your recent trip to Libya.
Well, I went to Libya twice during the aggression in May and then in June again. And I went mainly to the western part of Libya, Tripoli, Tripolitania, Fezzan, the area under the control of the legitimate government, which I consider a legitimate government. And I experienced the terrible effects of the constant NATO bombings, day and night, thousands and thousands of operations, of incursions into civilian areas. I witnessed the death, the mass killings, the woundings and the destruction of the effects of these bombings. And I also spoke to many, many, many people who in their absolute majority were against these NATO bombings, the war at large, and against the rebellion that started in Benghazi. The majority of these people thought that their life under the present government, the Gaddafi government, was, as also confirmed by the United Nations, one of the best standards in Africa. And therefore, they were determined to defend it, which is what they are doing.
What is your criticism of the world media?
The media, generally the mainstream media, the important media such as the New York Times, the Daily Telegraph, the Times, Washington Post and so on, they are owned, Murdoch's television channels, they're all owned by people who have an interest in these wars. They have an interest in the wars of conquest of areas, of countries that have resources, resources that they want, out of which they gain profit. So there is an identification with those that make the wars, that do the bombing, that organize the occupation, and those that speak about it. They move on parallel lines, on parallel rails, because they have shared interests.
Just seen a film that you made while you were out there, and there were some shocking images. Can you tell us about what the rebels did, but not in the graphic detail, to the black Africans?
Yes, well, this was something that shocked the world, because eventually, despite all the connivance of the mainstream media, some honest journalists managed to bring the truth to general knowledge. It was, among others, the Daily Telegraph was one of the first to denounce the unbelievable persecution of the blacks in Benghazi once the rebels had taken control of the city. No black man with a black skin, whether he was a Libyan or he was an immigrant from other African countries, felt safe anymore. They were being chased, they were being captured, they were being tortured, and they were being burned alive on many occasions. And this has been shown, has been documented by people who had the courage and the wits to take pictures of this by their mobile phones and let them filter through to the world. This is one of the most horrific aspects of this war. But not only the chasing of the black people out of sheer racism, they called them mercenaries. These people were not mercenaries. They were black Libyans and they were immigrant workers from other African countries.
I'm Dave Roberts from Global Civilians for Peace in Libya. We are an umbrella organization that's conducted three fact-finding missions between April until the fall of Tripoli recently. We've had people on the ground throughout. We've made three major reports of what we found there, and we've assisted in the production of a number of films, including Fulvio Grimaldi's film. And if anybody wants to find out what's actually going on in Libya, the reality of it, please get onto the website, globalcivilianforpeace.com.
In your opinion, is there a lot of media involved in propaganda?
There has been propaganda, Western propaganda, from day one. And people will be surprised that papers such as The Guardian have been at the cutting edge of propaganda, and, you know, not the traditional right-wing papers. If you go onto our website, you'll find Western sources where they are accurate being reproduced, irrespective of what sources they come from, and other sources as well.
Just one last thing. You know, they said that Gaddafi bombed his own people. Is that true or not?
The Resolution 1973 went through very quickly and very rapidly through the UN on the basis that Gaddafi had bombed three areas of Tripoli, Sukhjuma, Fashlum, and Trajura. On our first fact-finding mission in April, We visited those three areas. We pop-voxed numerous people. We filmed. There was no damage. Everybody that we interviewed came and said it was a pack of lies by the Western media, that it wasn't true. People were genuinely concerned that events were being taken out of their hands and that the whole thing had been done to start a war against Libya.
Thank you to Anthea Page. She was talking to Italian war correspondent Flavio Grimaldi, based in Rome, and also to David Roberts from the Global Civilians for Peace in Libya.
With me in the studio, I have Peter Gould, who is the chairman of the Ramblers Association Bristol Group. Hello, Peter.
Hello.
Thank you for joining us. So I'm sure lots of people have heard of the Ramblers Association before, but as a very brief introduction, could you inform those who maybe don't know what it is?
Well, we're a registered charity that was founded in 1935. We're supposed to encourage walking, to protect public rights of way, and campaign for access to open countryside.
Okay, and is that an issue at the moment? Is there plenty of problems with, you hear about irate farmers, for example, not letting people go across their land?
That's a perennial problem, although not perhaps a major one at the moment. The great live issue, I think, is access to open countryside in the extension of the right to roam, as it was called, to the coast path of England. This has gone a bit further ahead in Wales, but it's been rather dropped down the back of the filing cabinet in this country.
And what's the detail of that? What was that involving?
Well, the idea was that we should have a walking route right the way around the coast of England, excluding obvious things like docklands and really private gardens and so forth. And this would not just be a footpath, but it would be a footpath with a bit of room to spread on either side. This had been put on the statute book, but like many things on the statute book, it doesn't immediately come into being just because the government has voted for it. And we're now hoping that it will be picked up and carried forward, although
it seems to have ground to a halt.
Just at the moment, it does seem to have stalled.
Okay. So is there any particular lobbying that you're doing in order to get that at the top of the agenda again?
Well, we are doing the usual thing you would expect, really, talking to the appropriate bit of the civil service. We are approaching MPs and saying, you know, come on, this has been an issue for half a century. We thought it had been resolved. Please, can you make sure that this bit of legislation takes effect?
How kind of crucial is it in terms of the breadth of the walks that people can do with the Ramblers Association to include these coastal paths?
Well, apart from the Ramblers Association, there are an awful lot of people in this country who enjoy walking. Unfortunately, they don't all join us, but they still enjoy walking. And coastal walks are particularly popular because people like the sea.
So it's almost like a public right, in a way, that people should be able to roam these areas.
I would say that access to the countryside is a public right, and it has been recognised as a public right in respect of moorland and heath and unimproved grassland and mountain. The bit that wasn't taken forward was woodland and forest, which is unfortunate, but you know, we've waited 50 years, it'll come one day. And coastal walking was legislated for. It's just a matter of applying the legislation.
So that's kind of in the pipeline for the Ramblers Association to keep pushing that forward,
We keep pushing. And you have to bear in mind that we've been arguing for access to open countryside since we were invented in 1935, and people have been asking for it for about a century or more before that. So you are looking at a long-term process. In the 1940s, there was some legislation that didn't actually work. It was actually sabotaged by the civil service, but there was legislation. So we had to go through it all over again with the Countryside and Rights of Way Act 2000. But it was done piecemeal. So we got mountain, moor, heath, and unimproved downland. And the definition of unimproved downland, you'll have to get a specialised botanist to explain. But other things that had come into the definition of open countryside weren't done immediately. And some of it hasn't, legally speaking, been done yet. I hope to live to see it done, although I'm not over-optimistic.
So another hot topic on the walkers' agenda is dangerous incidents people have been having with cows and other livestock in fields.
Yes.
Could you tell me more about that?
Well, actually, the most dangerous incident I've had wasn't in a field. It was on a street in Bristol where a trainee police horse had a panic attack the other day. That's about the most dangerous thing I've ever been close to. But there have been a few incidents recently of people being attacked and even killed by cattle. The problem usually has to do with dogs. Now, if you take a dog into the countryside and take it near cattle, they may well get aggressive. And the standard advice is, let the dog go, it will look after itself. If you try to protect the dog, you will probably get injured as well. So the other problem with cattle tends to be with cows that have had calves. I was talking to a farmer's wife last week who put forward the theory that cows are actually subject to something akin to postnatal depression. And even a cow that's always been sedate can get very agitated when it's just given birth. And certainly if you get between a cow and its calf, you are inviting trouble.
I can imagine. So don't do that is the advice.
No. Leave it alone. Don't touch. Don't go near calves, however sweet they look. Don't go near lambs. Just leave it alone. Give it a wide berth.
Well, unfortunately, that's all we have time for. But if someone wants to find out more about your walks that you've put together around Bristol and also about the Ramblers Association, can you give us some details about how people could find out about those things?
Yes, the walks have been reprocessed, as it were, because the original book went out of date. And there are two free pamphlets available, one dealing with North and the other with South Bristol. And these should still be in the libraries or in the Tourist Information Officer. They can also be downloaded, and further information about the Ramblers can be found at bristolramblers.org.uk.
Amazing. Thank you very much, Peter.
Thank you.
Back to the theme of war and civil war, we now have a song from Duncan Moore about the English Civil War called Dominion of the Sword.
Hello.
What's your name?
Duncan Moore from Stoke-on-Trent.
And you're going to sing us a folk song?
Yes, this is Dominion of the Sword, which is a Civil War folk song from the English Civil War, and was recorded by Martin Carthy. And this version is a composite of Martin Carthy's version and lyrics from the original Civil War version.
Do you know anything about the Civil War?
Yes, there was essentially two Civil Wars. There was the first one started in 1645, then the second one started in 1655, I believe. And it was quite fundamental to sort of the British Constitution because it was the first time in history that, you know, a monarch had been sort of executed by his own population, certainly in Britain at any rate, I don't know about the rest of the world. And it was the first and only time that Britain had a commonwealth rather than, you know, a monarchy.
Which side was Stoke-on-Trent? Parliamentarians or King Charles?
I think Stoke was probably very pragmatic and went for whichever side was winning at the time.
Oh, one of those times.
Yes. My own family, which was traced back to sort of, you know, the 1600s, they were pretty much on the royalist side. They were sort of like yeoman farmers, and people in the countryside tended to be more royalist than those in the towns and in the industrial areas.
What's the song called?
This is Dominion of the Sword. Lay by your pleading, law lies a bleeding. Burn all your studies down and throw away your reading. Small power word has and can afford us not half as much privilege as the sword does. It'll foster disaster, plaster disaster. This will make a servant quickly greater than the master. Ventures, enters, seeks, and it centres. Ever the upper hand, never a dissenter. Talk of small things, this sets up all things. This will master money, the money masters all things. It is not season to talk of reason. Never call it loyal when the sword says treason. Subtle deceiver turns calm to fever. See the pilgrim flay the unbeliever. This will make a layman preach into prayman. This will make a lord of him who was but a drayman. Conquers the crown to furs and the gown to set you up a province, but quickly pull it down to no gospel can guide it, no law decide it, in church or state, till the sword sanctifies it. Take books, rent 'em, who can invent 'em? When, as the sword says, negator argumentum, blood that is spilt, sir, gains all the guilt, sir. Thus, if you see me, run my sword up to the hilt, sir.
Thank you very much to Duncan Moore and his song, Dominion of the Sword. Each week, our engineer Michael Noyce has invited a band to his house to sit on his sofa and have a cup of tea and a chat. And this week is no exception. We have an interview with a Bristol artist named Jacques A. Robin.
Hiya, on my sofa today I have a Jacques A. Robin.
Hi, Mike.
And you've also brought your singer Sue with you.
Yeah.
Basically, you're a songwriter, but you're not technically a solo artist as such.
Yeah, I'm a songwriter, but I tend to collaborate as much as I can with musicians, generally from the Bristol music scene, because I like to flesh up songs and not to be just, the typical bearded man with guitar.
Okay, so it's very difficult with genres. You don't want to get pigeonholed with things. So Is there any kind of keywords that you would use to describe your music?
Yeah, probably, especially for this first album I've just recorded, Statuettes, the word melancholy is a key word, not as an atmosphere in principle, but more like something that happens quite naturally when I sing and when I compose these songs. Really, they came from reflections on aspects of life that are a bit melancholy. But yeah, I'm not a melancholy person for the sake of it. It's more like trying to accept all aspects of life, even the darkest ones, and try to go through them.
Are your lyrics all quite dark, or is it that you just have a kind of melancholy air even when they're quite upbeat lyrics, if you like?
I think that there's probably very often a melancholy streak to them, but lyrics aren't necessarily dark. For me, they are not, actually. They are like a journey, you know, through melancholy and through other feelings to get something true, to get something authentic, and that's what I try to get to, a genuine kind of feeling. Yeah.
Okay, so do you just play the guitar yourself, or do you play other instruments on your album as well?
No, my album, I just sing and play guitar. Probably I play tambourine also. But the other instruments are all played by 15 other musicians. There's quite a big collection of musicians on this album, from cello to violin to flute, piano, drums, electric guitars, clarinet, there's a lot. Backing vocals, like my friend Sue Mara, she sings backing vocals.
Okay, but presumably that's rather a lot of people, so when you perform this stuff live, You won't be able to take all that many people with you.
No, very often not, because as you mentioned, it's more like a collective, a floaty kind of band. It's not a proper ongoing band project. It's my project with musicians floating about, and so when they are available they play with me, or depending on the situation. For example, I'm playing a couple of gigs in the next 2 months at Louisiana on the 29th of September and on the 28th of October in the new basement room, which is strictly acoustic, and for these occasions I will be only able to play with two other musicians. It depends on the situation.
Okay, so let's talk about your album, Statuettes.
Yeah.
That's just come out, has it?
Yep, yeah.
Okay, so is this on a record label, or is it self-produced? And
it's on my personal record label called Hortus, and so it's basically self-distributed for the moment and self-released.
Well, I think it's a revolution coming along with the music industry now, is that because the technology seems to be there, people are trying to bypass the large corporate record companies who basically take most of the money. So you set up your own record label and publish it, and if you get your own music recorded, then you're really looking for a distribution deal rather than an actual album deal as such.
I suppose there are nowadays, seems things are much more flexible than a couple of decades ago, or even just one decade ago probably. So you have quite a few possibilities and opportunities to self-promote your music online, for example. And maybe a distribution deal is one of the options to get a bit more visibility out there, because what I'm noticing is there's all these options to put your tracks out there on the big shops or on kind of social network-like things. They are good, but actually they're only based on word of mouth then, and it can be good, but then maybe you might need a bit more promotion there.
Okay, well, with that in mind, with your album, let's hear one of the tracks from it. We're going to do an exclusive live version. Can you introduce this song, please?
Yeah, we're going to play a song entitled Josephine and the Lantern. And yeah, I think it's quite a melancholy song, unsurprisingly. And the theme is probably some kind of psychological termination between two characters, but also being enchanted by this relationship of domination, so at accepting it, actually.
This is Jack and Robin with Josephine and the Lantern.
To be weak than to be strong. Like a statue, you lie by my side. I watch over you, there's nothing you can hide. Da-da-da-da-da. 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 As the moon calls you out of the darkness, I stretch over you to reach the lantern. With its quivering light burning softly, soon it falls into a beautiful sleep. La 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 da da da. La la da 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 da. La la da da da. Like her, the light is thrown to infinity. Josephine's wheel eclipsed by the clouds of sleep, laid aside like a dress upon a chair. She disappears and I look into the dark well. Such high stakes. When I lay my servant's cap with ease, content to catch the crumbs dropped from your lips. When at dawn the boats enter the bay, through our window the lanterns call the day. With the light I'll give my freedom away. This enchantment I got no will to break. Like her, the light is thrown into infinity. Josephine's will eclipsed by the clouds of sleep, laid aside like a dress upon a chair. She disappears and I look into a dark well.
That was Josephine and the Lantern by Jack and Robin. So if anyone likes the music and wants to get hold of it, where can they get your album?
The album is available in Bristol at Rise Records, the record shop on the Triangle. And online, you can buy the CD on Bandcamp or through my website, which is www.jackandrobin.com, and also through the major kind of distributors like iTunes, Napster, and Amazon, Spotify, etc.
And if people do just want to collaborate with you, can they get in contact with you?
Yeah, definitely. It's worth spelling out the name.
Jack, that's J-A-C-Q-U-E-S, a robin.
Yeah, a robin, like the bird.com. Yeah, so the website is jacquesarobin, one word, .com. And yeah, I'll be happy to hear from musicians who are willing to collaborate, especially from accordionist, because I've just lost my accordionist.
Very carelessly.
Very carelessly.
So do you have an email address as well? Or?
Yeah, the email address is jacques@jacquesarobin.com.
Okay, well, Jacques Arobin, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you very much to Michael Noyce, interviewing Bristol artist Jacques A. Robin.
Time now for part 4, chapter 22 of Treasure Island, written by Robert Louis Stevenson and read by Malcolm Grieve.
Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. Part 5, My Sea Adventure. Chapter 22, How I Began My Sea Adventure. There was no return of the mutineers, not so much as another shot out of the woods. They had got their rations for that day, as the captain put it, and we had the place to ourselves and a quiet time to overhaul the wounded and get dinner. Squire and I cooked outside in spite of the danger. And even outside we could hardly tell what we were at, for horror of the loud groans that reached us from the doctor's patients. Out of the 8 men who had fallen in the action, only 3 still breathed. That one of the pirates who had been shot at the loophole, Hunter, and Captain Smollett. And of these, the first 2 were as good as dead. The mutineer, indeed, died under the doctor's knife. And Hunter, do what we could, never recovered consciousness in this world. He lingered all day, breathing loudly like the old buccaneer at home in his apoplectic fit, but the bones of his chest had been crushed by the blow and his skull fractured in falling, and some time in the following night, without sign or sound, he went to his maker. As for the captain, his wounds were grievous indeed, but not dangerous. No organ was fatally injured. Anderson's ball, for it was Job that shot him first, had broken his shoulder blade and touched the lung, but not badly. The second had only torn and displaced some muscles in the calf. He was sure to recover, the doctor said, but in the meantime, and for weeks to come, he must not walk, nor move his arm, nor so much as speak, when he could help it. My own accidental cut across the knuckles was a flea bite. Dr. Livesey patched it up with plaster and pulled my ears for me into the bargain. After dinner, the squire and the doctor sat by the captain's side a while in consultation, and when they had talked to their heart's content, it being then a little past noon, the doctor took up his hat and pistols, girt on a cutlass, put a chart in his pocket, and with a musket over his shoulder, crossed the palisade on the north side and set off briskly through the trees. Grey and I were sitting together at the far end of the blockhouse to be out of earshot of our officers consulting, and Grey took his pipe out of his mouth and fairly forgot to put it back in again, so thunderstruck was he at this occurrence. "Why, in the name of Davy Jones," said he, "is Dr. Livesey mad?" "Why, no," says I, "he's about the last of this crew for that, I take it." "Well, shipmate," said Grey, "mad he may not be, but if he's not, you mark my words, I am." "I take it," replied I, "the doctor has his idea. And if I am right, he's going now to see Ben Gunn." I was right, as it appeared later. But in the meantime, the house being stiflingly hot, and the little patch of sand inside the palisade ablaze with midday sun, I began to get another thought into my head, which was not by any means so right. What I began to do was to envy the doctor, walking in the cool shadow of the woods with the birds about him and the pleasant smell of the pines, while I sat grilling with my clothes stuck to the hot resin, and so much blood around me, and so many poor dead bodies lying all around, that I took a disgust of the place that was almost as strong as fear. All the time I was washing out the blockhouse, and then washing up the things from dinner, this disgust and envy kept growing stronger and stronger. Till at last, being near a bread bag and no one then observing me, I took the first step towards my escapade and filled both pockets of my coat with biscuit. I was a fool, if you like, and certainly I was going to do a foolish, over-bold act, but I was determined to do it with all the precautions in my power. These biscuits, should anything befall me, would keep me at least from starving till far on in the next day. The next thing I laid hold of was a brace of pistols, and as I already had a powder horn and bullets, I felt myself well supplied with arms. As for the scheme in my head, it was not a bad one in itself. I was to go down the sandy spit that divides the anchorage on the east from the open sea, find the white rock I had observed last evening, and ascertain whether it was there or not that Ben Gunn had hidden his boat. A thing quite worth doing, as I still believe. But as I was certain I should not be allowed to leave the enclosure, my only plan was to take French leave and slip out when nobody was watching. And that was so bad a way of doing it as to make the thing itself wrong. But I was only a boy, and I had made my mind up. Well, as things at last fell out, I found an admirable opportunity. The squire and Grey were busy helping the captain with his bandages. The coast was clear. I made a bolt for it over the stockade and into the thickest of the trees, and before my absence was observed, I was out of cry of my companions. This was my second folly, far worse than the first, as I left but two sound men to guard the house. But, like the first, it was a help towards saving all of us. I took my way straight for the east coast of the island, for I was determined to go down the seaside of the spit to avoid all chance of observation from the anchorage. It was already late in the afternoon, although still warm and sunny. As I continued to thread the tall woods, I could hear from far before me not only the continuous thunder of the surf, but a certain tossing of foliage and grinding of boughs, which showed me the sea breeze had set in higher than usual. Soon, cool draughts of air began to reach me, and a few steps farther, I came forth into the open borders of the grove, and saw the sea lying blue and sunny to the horizon, and the surf tumbling and tossing its foam along the beach. I have never seen the sea quiet around Treasure Island. The sun might blaze overhead, the air be without a breath, the surface smooth and blue, but still these great rollers would be running along all the external coast, thundering and thundering by day and night, and I scarce believe there is one spot in the island where a man would be out of earshot of their noise. I walked along beside the surf with great enjoyment, till thinking I was now got far enough to the south, I took the cover of some thick bushes and crept warily up to the ridge of the spit. Behind me was the sea, in front the anchorage. The sea breeze, as though it had the sooner blown itself out by its unusual violence, was already at an end. It had been succeeded by light, variable airs from the south and south-east, carrying great banks of fog, and the anchorage under the lee of Skeleton Island lay still and leaden as when we first entered it. The Hispaniola, in that unbroken mirror, was exactly portrayed from the truck to the waterline, the Jolly Roger, hanging from her peak. Alongside lay one of the gigs, silver in the starn sheets. Him I could always recognise, while a couple of men were leaning over the starn bulwarks, one of them with a red cap, the very rogue that I had seen some hours before stride legs upon the palisade. Apparently they were talking and laughing, though at that distance, upwards of a mile, I could, of course, hear no word of what was said. All at once, there began the most horrid, unearthly screaming, which at first startled me badly, although I had soon remembered the voice of Captain Flint, and even thought I could make out the bird by her bright plumage, as she sat perched upon her master's wrist. Soon after, the jolly boat shoved off and pulled for shore, and the man with the red cap and his comrade went below by the cabin companion. Just about the same time, the sun had gone down behind the spyglass, and as the fog was collecting rapidly, it began to grow dark in earnest. I saw that I must lose no time if I were to find the boat that evening. The white rock, visible enough above the brush, was still some eighth of a mile further down the spit, and it took me a goodish while to get up with it, crawling, often on all fours, amongst the scrub. Night had almost come when I laid my hand on its rough sides. Right below it, there was an exceeding small hollow of green turf, hidden by banks and a thick underwood about knee-deep that grew there very plentifully, and in the centre of that dell, sure enough, a little tent of goatskins, like what the gypsies carry about with them in England. I dropped into the hollow, lifted the side of the tent, and there was Ben Gunn's boat. Homemade, if ever anything was homemade. A rude, lopsided framework of tough wood, and stretched upon that a covering of goatskin with the hair inside. The thing was extremely small, even for me, and I can hardly imagine that it could have floated with a full-sized man. There was one thwart, set as low as possible, a kind of stretcher in the bows, and a double paddle for propulsion. I had not seen a coracle such as the ancient Britons made, but I have seen one since, and I can give you no fairer idea of Ben Gunn's boat than by saying it was like the first and the worst coracle ever made by man. But the great advantage of the coracle it certainly possessed, for it was exceedingly light and portable. Well, now that I had found the boat, you would have thought I had had enough of truantry for once. But in the meantime, I had taken another notion, and become so obstinately fond of it, that I would have carried it out, I believe, in the teeth of Captain Smollett himself. This was to slip out under cover of the night, cut the Hispaniola adrift and let her go ashore where she fancied. I had quite made up my mind that the mutineers, after their repulse of the morning, had nothing nearer their hearts than to up anchor and away to sea. This, I thought, it would be a fine thing to prevent. And now that I had seen how they left their watchmen unprovided with a boat, I thought it might be done with little risk. Down I sat to wait for darkness, and made a hearty meal of biscuit. It was a night out of 10,000 for my purpose. The fog had now buried all heaven. As the last rays of daylight dwindled and disappeared, absolute blackness settled down on Treasure Island, and when at last I shouldered the coracle and groped my way stumblingly out of the hollow where I had supped, there were but two points visible on the whole anchorage. One was the great fire on shore by which the defeated pirates lay carousing in the swamp. The other, a mere blur of light upon the darkness, indicated the position of the anchored ship. She had swung round to the ebb. Her bow was now towards me. The only lights on board were in the cabin, and what I saw was merely a reflection on the fog of the strong rays that flowed from the stern window. The ebb had already run some time, and I had to wade through a long belt of swampy sand where I sank several times above the ankle before I came to the edge of the retreating water, and wading a little in, with some strength and dexterity, set my coracle, keel downwards, on the surface. We'll be right back.
That was part 4, chapter 22 of Treasure Island, written by Robert Louis Stevenson and read by Malcolm Grieve. Thank you very much, Malcolm. It's my pleasure to introduce Tim Burrows back in the studio. Hi, Tim.
Hi, yeah.
And you've got a song for us today. It's called Songlines from the Dreamtime. Can you tell us a bit more about where you wrote it?
Yes, I wrote this song a couple of years ago now in Alice Springs in Australia, and I'd been reading some of Bruce Chapman's work about the Aborigine songlines and the history that the songline, the history of ancestors is kept in the songline. So I thought, this is a great idea for a song. And being there, I kind of stung it together with this idea of movement and also the idea there's some ancient legends that people sang before they spoke. So this was the idea that this song kind of brings those few ideas together. So I hope you like it. Time and again I hit the road to find the world in you, to find some words to fit my life and maybe find love too. For movement is the pulse of verse, the rhythm of the song, the murmur of the whispering tongue that fills the mouth that's dumb. Sing the world into being, join the ancestors' song, to map their progress across the land, unite the tribes in song.
Many thanks, Tim. Thank you.
Thank you.
Time to hand over to Jeff Sparks, who is sitting steady as a rock so that his leather jacket does not creak in front of our microphone. Jeff, what is on this week?
Thank you. Hello, this is your What's On guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday, October 7th, Top Loader will be performing with support from Silhouette Showgirls and also brought into being at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are £15 in advance. On Sunday, October 9th, Ugly Duckling, who are an American hip-hop group, will be performing at the Victoria at 88 Victoria Road, Swindon. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £10 in advance, which can be purchased at www.ctickets.com. Staying on 9th of October, Wheatus will be performing with support from MC Frontalot, Math the Band and also City Stereo at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets cost £11 in advance. Finally, on Monday 10th of October, the dub stroke rock crossover group Dub Trio will be performing with support from Mr. Shiraz, Merrick and also Rocket in Your Pocket at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets cost £10 in advance. That's all from me. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you very much, Jeff.
That's all from Dialect this week. Studio guests were Stephen Loss-Simpson and Peter Gould from the Ramblers Association.
The feature was by Anthea Page. Thank you to Malcolm Greig for reading part 4, chapter 22 of Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. Thank you to Duncan Moore also for singing a song, and also to Tim Burrows who did the same. The artist Jack the Robin was interviewed by Michael Noyce, and the What's On Guide was by Jess Sparks. So, goodbye from myself, John Peters Coleman.
And me, Michaela Dennis. The engineer this week was Michael Noyce, and the producer was Anthea Page. Till next week, goodbye.
Goodbye.
He's gone and sent in the marines.